Welcome to the Religious Studies Project, hosted by David Robertson and myself, Christopher Cotter. This podcast is produced in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, and you can visit our website at www.religiousstudiesproject.com. Well, following our recent interviews with Callum Brown and Ariella Kazar, we thought we would take a closer look at quantitative research in religious studies, how to go about it, what it is, how it works, and as well as that, discussing some of the intrinsic problems and limitations of this methodology. We thought the best person to ask would be Professor David Vos, who is Professor of Population Studies at the University of Essex and is widely published and acknowledged expert in this field.
As social scientists, many of the questions that come up in studying religion are by nature quantitative. We're concerned about issues such as the growth or decline of religious institutions, whether alternative spirituality is growing, and if so, how fast and for how long that's been going on. We want to know whether women are more religious than men and why. Are evangelicals being successful in a way that others aren't? Are young Muslims more committed, or perhaps not quite as committed, as their parents living in the West? So all of these issues are essentially, I think it's fair to say, quantitative. They're to do with how much, how far, how long, to what extent, and involve comparisons more than less than that are implicitly or indeed explicitly quantitative.
And quantitative research is often paired off with qualitative research. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could tell me a little bit about the difference between these approaches in their applicability and their usefulness.
Mm-hmm. I'll just start by saying what I see the strengths of quantitative research are. They're first of all very good at describing who's religious, how committed they are, by other variables of interest: age, sex, ethnicity, class, and so on. They can be used to tell us how far religion and religiosity, I'll explain that term more in a minute, are associated with values, attitudes and behavior of many kinds, political leanings, marriage, education, employment, and so on. And quantification often provides the best, or occasionally almost the only way, of testing some of the major theories that we have in the sociology of religion. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. These theories are general theories. We need to be able to generalize, and survey methods permit generalization in a way that smaller scale studies don't. Now, as against that, I think qualitative methods score in giving you much greater depth about the meanings that people attach to things. So if you want to know what people mean when they say that they're a Christian, for example, it helps to have a conversation about that. Mm-hmm. There are some clues that we can pick up from structured surveys, but it's more difficult. And of course, you'll want to go off and talk to qualitative people about the strengths of their methods. But I think there are areas where the depth that you get from qualitative research can be important.
And how does that relate to this distinction that you made between religiosity and religion?
So religion would be kind of category related to ethnicity, if you like, that pigeonholes someone as Anglican or Methodist, Muslim or Hindu, and is a way of describing either their affiliation as defined from the outside or their identification as defined by themselves. But that needs to be distinguished, I think, from degree of religious commitment or religious involvement, for which we use the term religiosity. Mm-hmm. The term religiosity, I should say, is used outside the field in a slightly pejorative way to mean excessive and perhaps insincere commitment to religion. Here I'm mm-hmm. using it in an entirely neutral, technical way, simply to mean degree of religious commitment. And of course, one can identify oneself as Methodist, Mormon, or Muslim, but be of very different levels of involvement in those religions. You can be either a nominal affiliate or somebody who's deeply committed and very active, mm-hmm. and often it's religiosity that is of interest to us as much as or even more than the specific affiliation.
And are they both equally accessible to quantitative methods?
It's a good question. Self-identification or affiliation is fairly easy to get at least in a crude way. You can simply ask people whether they regard themselves mm-hmm. as belonging to a particular religion, or you can, as done on the British census, ask straight out, what is your religion? Actually, that's the question in England and Wales, not to be confused with the one in Scotland and Northern Ireland. So I think self-identification is not too problematic, although there are issues even there. Many people sit on the fence and will say one thing one day and a different thing mm-hmm. another day. Religious commitment is trickier. First of all, it's arguably multidimensional, or at any rate can be measured in different ways. As a function of belief, for example, as a matter of religious practice, perhaps to do with values or something else. And exactly how one operationalizes, to use the jargon, this notion or concept of religiosity is something that has been debated for decades, and people will continue to debate for as long as the sociology of religion exists.
Mm. Let's switch tack then to the kind of research methods that would be used in quantitative mm-hmm. research in religion. I mean, the obvious things that spring to mind are questionnaires and the census, which you mentioned just recently. Mm. Is that all of the resources we have, or are there other things which I haven't mentioned?
Yes. Well, in terms of methods, I think there are two things that one would want to distinguish. One is methods of data collection, and the other is methods of data analysis. Mm-hmm. The data that we collect often come in the form of surveys. So these would be instruments where typically individuals, though sometimes organizations, for example, churches or mosques or synagogues or indeed mm-hmm. Other sorts of organizations, would be asked questions. And if it's an organizational group that's the unit of analysis, then some key informants will give the responses on behalf of the group. At any rate, there's that approach to collecting data through surveys, but then we also get information that's collected by institutions for their own purposes. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the Church of England will routinely gather from their diocese, and in turn diocese from the parish churches, information about how many people attend in a typical week or on a given Sunday, how many baptisms, weddings, and funerals they've performed, certain financial information, and so on. And then that data are available to us on an aggregate level, so we can go away and analyze it. Another important distinction, I think, to make is between primary data collection, where the researcher, him or herself, has a question in mind or a set of research questions, designs a questionnaire, and then goes off and collects the data, or organizes or commissions the data collection. As against that, a lot of people, and I'm certainly one of them, spend more time, in fact, on the analysis of existing data sets. Mm-hmm. So that's typically referred to as the secondary analysis of data. The idea being that the data have been gathered for other purposes, and we're exploiting something that already exists. In fact, I should say, many times these are surveys that are conducted not with any other specific purpose in mind, but simply to be general resources for the scholarly community. So here one thinks of leading national surveys, the British Social Attitude Survey, the General Social Survey in the United States and Canada, but then also international survey programs, the European Social Survey, the ISSP International Social Survey Program, the EVS, the European Value Study, and so on. These are all very important resources.
Talking about these large data projects, then how would one go about planning such a thing, and then taking that planning into reality? Mm-hmm. And
are you thinking about data collection or exploitation of existing?
That's a good question. There wasn't a distinction that I was really aware of until you were talking about it just now. Let's start with a primary one where a scholar has a particular thing that they're trying to establish.
Mm, right.
How would you go about designing a questionnaire?
Mm. Well, there's the questionnaire that, of course, is largely going to be a function of the issues that you're most concerned with, though you need to test it carefully to make sure that you're getting at those issues, mm-hmm, and that people understand the questions and are responding in ways that are useful to you. Of equal and sometimes greater importance, or at least of greater challenge, is to design the sample. Mm-hmm. And for that, you need a sampling frame of some sort. That is, you need to know the starting point for selecting individuals or organizations that are going to be participating in your survey. Now, in some cases, this is relatively straightforward. I mean, if you were content, for example, to draw a sample of students at your university,
mm-hmm,
it would be,
happens,
yeah. Yes, then with the permission of somebody in the administration, you could probably send an email to a fraction of students randomly selected, asking them to complete a form, for example. If you're interested in, let's say, the attitudes of young Muslim women, then it's very much more difficult because there is no list of all young Muslim women in the country. And so then you have to start getting creative about where you're going to find these people. The difficulty is that to use statistical methods in the analysis and to be able to come up with reliable figures with measurable standard errors or margins of error, you really need some random sampling method. It's not enough to go out and take a convenient sample where you know, you happen to come across 100 young Muslim women, to use my example, mm-hmm, because there's no way of knowing whether those women are in fact actually representative of the population. If they're ones that just are, in a sense, available to you, the chances are they will not be like all people in the class that you're interested in, mm-hmm, important respects.
I heard Callum Brown recently, who's just kind of moved into a very quantitative research area, saying that he thought the demographic group that the future will know the most about is students at social science unis, because almost every undergraduate survey is based on them.
Well, notoriously, psychologists use samples of students for many, many studies, and so there are a huge number of psychology papers based on samples of students. But yes, to some extent, sociologists do the same thing.
And how would that process of going about a project like that be different in a secondary or on a survey based on secondary sources?
Well, then, of course, you bypass all the difficulties associated with collecting and inputting the data. And that means both an enormous savings of time, but perhaps more importantly of money, because gathering data can be extremely expensive, particularly if you're looking for high quality, large random samples. You know, if you wanted to survey 1,000 individuals, which is often seen as being kind of a minimum figure for really worthwhile quantitative analysis, then you're talking about an enormous number of interviews, potentially some difficult sampling problems, and then a lot of data input, and this is all very expensive. Mm-hmm. So it makes it very much easier if you can use existing data. Obviously, there's a trade-off, and the trade-off is that the people who designs the questionnaire that generates the data you'll be using didn't have your particular research questions in mind.
Yeah. So you have the data, and that's it.
Yes, yeah. That's right. What's there is there, and there's nothing you can do about it.
How has computer technology changed the field? I'm thinking, initially I was thinking about in terms of being able to find these random pools of them. Surely, for instance, to find 1,000 Muslim women, to continue with the same example, would be easier if you can connect with them through Facebook, for instance. Mm-hmm. But also, I'm guessing if you're talking about a large pool of data such as the census, then having computers to analyse that data is surely going to really bring out a lot more, well, a lot easier to bring out the data.
Yes, it has made an enormous difference. To start on the data collection side, since that was your first question, it has generated some very interesting possibilities, though, of course, it's not necessarily an easy solution. So you're quite right. You could get 1,000 young Muslim women through Facebook, but those 1,000 women would not necessarily look like a random sample of Muslim women in the population. I mean, first of all, you know, the very fact that they're using Facebook means that they're likely to be different. But also, of course, they would be selecting themselves into your sample. You can, and this is a great technique, actually, purchase a little advert that will flash up on their screen saying, would you like to take part in the survey? It will only take 2 minutes and you can win an iPod or whatever. But still, very quickly people will see what the survey is about and they'll either continue or they'll bail out. And if the survey isn't something that's of great interest to them, or they're rushed or whatever, they're just not going to do it. And so you're going to have to ask the question, are people who agree to participate like or not like the general population that you want to be in touch with? So that's one issue. I think you're right, there's some great possibilities in web surveying. But one does have to be conscious that there are problems about getting a good representative sample. On the analysis side, it's very clear that modern computing power has greatly increased what we're able to do, and it makes it much easier to do things that before would have been very difficult. So when I was doing my PhD quite some years ago, I was using computers, but I was using punch cards as forms of input and using programming languages that would not have been easy for a lot of people to learn and use. Whereas now statistical software is really quite user-friendly. Within the space of a couple of hours, undergraduates can be taught to produce basic statistics from an existing data set.
Well, it might liberate some earlier data sets for new novel purposes, for instance.
Indeed. Of course, those data sets have to be put in a form amenable to analysis using modern technology, and often the data that were collected a long time ago now exists just in a hard copy form. So there are input problems there. But you're right. So I think there are some interesting possibilities for going back and doing comparative research over time of that sort.
A related issue in terms of this kind of choosing your data pool is and also this issue of people self-selecting to be involved in things, mm-hmm. is the issue of how much they're telling the truth. The kind of person who is likely to self-select to be involved in a survey of Muslim female Facebook users, for instance, may have particular issues that are driving them to take part. Can we always trust that they're telling the truth? I mean,
I don't think there's ever any guarantee that people are being completely honest in any form of interview, whether it's a very structured survey or a very unstructured one. So it's entirely possible that you could have just a free-flowing interview with somebody and not be sure to what extent they're being totally frank about their interests and motivations and so on. That said, in general, I think our evidence is that people do want to tell the truth. They're, apart from anything else, it's easier to give a correct answer than make up an incorrect one. Where that's more questionable is on issues that are sensitive for some reason or another, or that have this element of social desirability about them. So, well, again, to use an example from religion related to Muslims, if you ask people how many times a day they pray, you find very high proportion of Muslims saying that they pray five times a day, which we know, of course, is what's seen to be the obligation. I think there's good reason to believe that not all of them are, in fact, praying that often. Mm-hmm. Similarly, if you ask Christians, at least in the United States and probably elsewhere, how often they go to church, or even very specifically, have you yourself attended church in the last 7 days? The relationship between the answers you get and the head count that you obtain if you go round all of the local churches is very different. There's a well-known paper by Hadway, Mahler, and Chaves, in which they did precisely that sort of study. And year in, year out, 40% of Americans have said that they themselves in the past 7 days have been to church or a synagogue. And in fact, our current best estimates of the number who have actually attended in the last week is more like 22 or 23%. Now, there are reasons for that. I think sometimes people actually don't want to mislead you, and so are telling you an untruth because they think that the truth will be misleading. Mm. In other words, they think of themselves as the kind of person who does go to church, a church-going individual. And, of course, it is not necessarily the case that even people who think of themselves as churchgoers are in church every single Sunday. But they might think that that's the sort of thing they would normally plan to do. And so if you ask them, they respond not with what they actually did in the past 7 days, but what they think they would typically do.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, that the whole idea of having people say, this is what I believe and this is what I do, is quite a simplification of human nature, isn't it? We don't always have clear-cut delineations. I mean, I personally struggle to tick any of the boxes on the survey because I don't consider myself to be any of the things which it's asking me to identify as.
Yes, this comes back to the problem of operationalizing religious involvement that I mentioned earlier. I think it's particularly problematic with new forms of spirituality, or if you like, alternative spirituality, often referred to as the New Age, because there's so many different things that are embraced by that term, or that could be thought to fall under that umbrella, that trying to get at whether somebody is spiritual in the sense that sociologists might mean is really very difficult. You know, you could run down a whole list of beliefs that one might think are characteristic of the New Age and see how many of those the respondent assented to. You might list a whole range of activities and see how many people said that they had practiced. You can ask for their self-identification. You know, mm-hmm. Do you think of yourself mm-hmm. as spiritual? And in some ways, that's the most straightforward. But again, it's not easy because many religious people also think of themselves as spiritual. And people who aren't religious in any sort of sense that we might think of would nonetheless hesitate to say that they're not spiritual. Mm-hmm. Anyway, mm-hmm. There are difficulties of measurements here. I would certainly agree to that.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking of the Kendall Project there, I think, in part, anyway. There's also, though, an issue in New Age milieu, particularly in that it's fundamentally based on alterity and a rejection of institutionalization of belief, and so therefore, as soon as you ask them, are you this? There's an automatic impulse to say no. Mm-hmm. You know,
So people don't like to pigeonhole themselves. They don't like to say, I have these beliefs and not those beliefs. In some cases, they'll do that. Mm-hmm. But we're generally probably concerned to appear open-minded and rational, of course. Things that may not be associated with a rather strict pigeonholing into one category or another. I think the Kendall Project was an admirable example of an attempt, and I think really a very successful attempt in many ways, to quantify the holistic milieu. But the authors themselves would agree that even so, it took a huge amount of time and effort, and mm-hmm. still, you know, gives us results that are in some ways debatable.
Yeah.
Is somebody who attends a yoga class led by somebody who thinks that this is a spiritual activity themselves spiritual and part of the milieu?
One aspect of the census that Chris and I often discuss is the Jedi web campaign, which in the 2001 mm-hmm. census led to, I believe, 14,000 people. I'm not sure if that's the figure for Scotland or for Britain.
Yes,
that's Scotland, is it?
Yes, in England and Wales, there were 390,000 self-identified Jedis.
Now, that's an example. They were not self-identifying as Jedis. Rather, they were critiquing the idea mm-hmm. of there being a census of what you believe. And in fact, they very effectively, although I don't think this was their intention, but they very effectively distorted the figures for 2001 on these alternative religions and the New Age beliefs and so on and so forth. Mm. Because we don't know what those people were. Were they atheists? Mm-hmm. Were they nothing? Were they just agnostics? Or were they members of these kind of... Were they Wiccans? We don't know.
Yes. I think that's true. You know, exactly what the motivations were of all of those people is certainly open to debate. I think in many cases they just saw it as a bit of a joke and a way to, in a sense, mildly rebel against this prescribed civic duty of completing the census form. The Office for National Statistics in England and Wales decided to regard them as people who had no religion. I suspect that was probably the best decision in the circumstances, but I agree with you that we certainly can't be sure that absence that campaign, that was of course an international one, the whole English-speaking world that had census rounds from 2000-2001 and religion questions on the census forms were affected by it. Mm-hmm. So, absent that campaign, many of those people might have said something entirely different.
Yeah. A final critique, and then I'll lay off the quantitative research critiques. Is to do with the questions and how the questions being asked can reflect the preconceptions of researchers and maybe even lead into the answers they're looking for. I just want to read you this quote from Abby Day's article from 2010 in Culture and Religion. Sociologists of religion have based their arguments on quantitative data that asked questions using religious vocabulary to form questions such as, do you believe in God? And deploying Christian-centered values such as, do you think homosexuality is wrong? The results are mixed depending on the survey, but tend to reflect propositional forms of belief only. How would you respond to that charge?
As I said at the outset, I think it's entirely true that not everything can be measured through surveys, and what people mean by whatever they say is often better investigated using qualitative methods. Mm-hmm. So I'm definitely not proposing that quantitative methods should be used to the exclusion of anything else. Though I have to say that at the moment, I think the situation, at least in British sociology of religion, is rather the reverse, that there's too little quantitative research and rather than too much. It's a standard charge that religion is so complex that in practice one can't record and classify beliefs and behavior in this area in a satisfactory way. But I think the need to measure is a strength as well as weakness. You know, it's certainly true that quantification simplifies, but it also forces us to be clear about what we're studying. And the very act of defining variables imposes a kind of rigor and also, of course, lays us open to criticism in a way that one can more easily escape if you're using discursive treatments. So while I do accept that there are problems about some of the simple ways of operationalizing religious involvement, I do think that on the other hand, it means that we are able to say, ah, but what about people who think this and not that, for example? And it is fairly clear what you are and aren't getting.
And these criticisms notwithstanding, I mean, quantitative research is kind of having a bit of a renaissance, isn't it? It does seem to be more in the spotlight than it was, say, 10 years ago.
Perhaps. I think religion is more in the spotlight than it was 10 years ago. And quantification is part of that. The quantitative approach has always been strong in other countries. One thinks particularly of the United States, where there's a very strong survey-based tradition, but also in some of the Nordic countries and elsewhere in Europe. I hope that more and more people will be interested in using the data sets that are available and the tools for analysis that we have to hand and that actually are developing all the time. In many ways, it's a difficult area to keep up with because you do need to continue your professional developments, if you like, just to keep up with current methods. But there is a lot there. There are almost unlimited possibilities. And I think particularly because it is relatively underused at the moment in Britain, there are just lots of opportunities for young scholars in particular.
Well, that's a perfect place to end, because hopefully there'll be a number of young scholars listening to this podcast who will take some inspiration away from this interview. So I'll say thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You've just been listening to David speaking with David Vose at this year's Socrel Conference at the University of Chester last March. Next week, we're very pleased to bring you another interview from Jonathan Tuckett, our other interviewer, who is speaking with Naomi Goldenberg on the topic of religion as a vestigial state. Now, I know Naomi Goldenberg is from the University of Ottawa, and she was on a sort of UK tour a couple of months ago, so we were very pleased to catch her at the University of Stirling, and we are very grateful to Michael Martin and everyone at the University of Stirling for facilitating Jonathan's conversation with Professor Goldenberg. So I know that that's going to be a very good interview for you. Just a couple of other bits of news. You may be interested, you may be not. I, Chris, can I confirm officially that I will be starting a PhD in religious studies at Lancaster University from the start of October. So perhaps our podcast will start to become a little less Edinburgh-centric. Who knows? And on that note as well, we do have some very interesting plans afoot regarding interviews on other continents in the coming months. So do just bear with us and we will release that information as and when we feel it's right. Please do check us out on Facebook. We've passed 400 followers on Facebook. We've got about 300 followers on Twitter. And there's a lot of extra discussion goes on there, a lot of extra links that get posted out by ourselves, by our listeners, and by people who probably never even listen, but just like the sort of hub that they're becoming. Do comment on the website. Do check us out on iTunes, subscribe, and please, word of mouth is a big thing. So if you're a lecturer, if you can tell your students, if you are a fellow student, just pass the things on. If you're a member of the public, hell, everyone is basically interested in this stuff at a fundamental level, in my opinion anyway. So just anything you can do to tell people about us, to rate us on iTunes, would be greatly appreciated. And for now, thanks for listening.